This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by Resilient. Go find it on Kickstarter now.
Attention, citizens. It's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how a genre gets made. I am your host, Gregory Kamichuk, and I have left all of my regular co-hosts somewhere in a secret bunker in Winnipeg, and I have gone all the way out to the West Coast, virtually, to meet with George McHale, a comic book writer, a comic book maker, all around a good guy who's going to talk to us today about his journey making comics, independent and otherwise. Welcome, George.
Dude, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. You know, it's strange as usual not to be able to see all the people I know from the road face to face, but this is the closest proximity, and so I'll take it. You've got some exciting stuff going on, but for the dear listener who's wondering, who is this person, why don't you tell a little bit about your journey into comics?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always wanted to make comic books ever since I was a little boy. I grew up in, you know, the 90s, the Batman, the animated series, the X-Men cartoon. Silver Surfer was my first jam. The Marvel trading cards, I was obsessed with those. I just loved it. I had a copy of How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way by John Buscema, and I just like wore that book out, just practicing at the kitchen table day after day. I'd make board games like myself and play them with like my little brother, and I just always loved comic books and this medium. And as I got older, I got into high school, I got a little bit distracted by girls, not that I was dating any girls, but I was distracted by them nonetheless.
And as a concept, as a philosophy, they got in your way, right?
Yeah. Yes,
I see. Yeah.
And it kind of fell away, and then as I got a little bit older, I just got like really nervous and afraid of like trying to pursue doing something creative. I just didn't really think it was very like a possible thing. It's not a gig that you just like hand in a resume and, you know, you start on Monday sort of thing. You kind of got to crack in yourself, and I didn't know how to go about it, so I just kind of left it to the side. And a lot of it was fear of rejection, you know, fear of failure. So I just never bothered with it until I was like 35, and I really felt like there was just kind of something missing, and I wanted to go after my, you know, my creative eagerness to create. And so I did finally, you know, just a few years back. And I spent 6 months writing my first script, and I think it turned out pretty good. I did like 6 revisions on it, just, you know, kind of trying to make it better every time. And then I sat down to draw it, and I was pretty good when I was like 10, 12 years old, but not drawing for, you know, 20 plus years. I needed professional help in that department. So I started looking around for different people to create with.
I'm going to interrupt you here because I'm fascinated by a particular set of details here. You sat down and you made the script. And you wrote the script out first, and then you set about drawing it. I find that to be fascinating, that it was a sudden discovery to you after you've written the script that maybe you would need someone else to draw it, that you had just powered through the script, confident that it would be you, until it was too late. What was that like? What was that realization like?
It was a little bit disappointing. I knew that, I don't like, I think I could have maybe learned to draw again, but it's a skill, right? It's a skill that you really got to work at. And just having left it alone for so long, it wasn't there. And so if I would have like spent, you know, 5 years kind of teaching myself how to draw, then I could have drew my own book. But, you know, at that point I just felt like, okay, I'm just going to hire someone who's like way better than I am by like a million miles and just get going on that in that way.
What I like about this is that many people who are trying to break into comics or getting into comics, they often don't have the self-awareness to realize that they can kind of do it, but it's not quite up to a professional level. And you seem to have that, you know, you had that awareness to say, I can draw pretty good, but I can't, you could draw well enough, I think, to know that you couldn't draw well enough.
I've had this conversation with other people too, where it's like talent, and they talk about how important it is to be talented, and I'm just like, well, yeah, is it talent or is it you know, being able to evaluate yourself, right? Like, I don't know, I've done like quite a few like home renovation projects and things like that, and I'm not a professional, but I can look at a job and say, okay, that's not done right, I'm gonna go back and fix it. It might take me like, you know, five times as long as a pro, but I can get a professional looking product eventually, you know, on a home renovation thing, you know? So I think it's can be the same with comics too. And I think the more you do it, the better you get.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The more you do it, the better you get. Now, did you, when you were going from script to pages and then decided you were going to get someone else to come in, did you provide layouts or did you provide any of your original designs or drawings, or did you just let that artist, when you brought them in, do their thing?
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to get, eventually, Ali Garza. She's worked on like Deadpool and Teen Titans, and industry veteran of like, you know, 25 plus years, incredible talent. I wasn't about to tell him how to do it. You know what I mean? Yeah, so I do with my panel description. Sometimes I'm starting to go away from it the more books I make, but in the early days, I'd lay out kind of the page layout, how I had it envisioned in my mind, like, okay, you know, panel one, top quarter of page, full width and things like this, and really kind of describe the panels pretty intricately. And then as I go along, when I'm working with an artist that I really trust, I just leave panel one, panel two, panel three, and they decide how the page layout goes.
Right. Yeah. I tend to fall in that. That's what I prefer when I'm working with a writer. I mean, I'm often writing my own things, but if I'm working or collaborating with a writer, I'd rather them not tell me the constituent parts. I'd rather them give me kind of the ingredient list and let me mix it and match it the way that works the best, right? But I think a useful thing that you're bringing up that our dear listener might take away from this is that the total number of panels on a page, even if you're not describing them, I think is important for the rhythm of writing a script, right? To know that you need five beats or three beats or four beats, or you're going to leave a whole page. Those are important things. How do you get there in a story yourself?
How do I pace the book?
Yeah. What's that pacing like for you?
Well, I try and do a lot of planning before I sit down and start actually writing. And I'll plot out my scripts. I've started kind of writing in scenes. And so I might try and have like 10 or 12 scenes in a single comic. And pretty much all my scenes are always two pages, just for the most part, like unless it's a longer scene. And I kind of break it down like that. But then, so I really have everything like kind of blocked out pretty strongly. But then when I actually sit down to write it, when I go to write the dialogue, I try and like just kind of forget that. And then I just try and get into dialogue, and I won't really worry about it that much. A lot of times I'll go in like my hot tub and I'll have a few drinks and kind of loosen up and kind of maybe float and go into like imagination land. I know I'm sounding kind of like hippie-ish, but I just like to kind of really relax and like imagine a conversation between two people. So if I can do that, I feel like it's a lot more natural. So, and not worrying so much about the structure at that point. And then after I've done that, then I'll take a look at it and be like, all right, yeah, this is going to work. And I'll cut it into panels and I'll take, okay, I got two word balloons here, two word balloons there, and just kind of cut it into panels.
What I create, I must control. Go on, activate this body.
You brought up this idea of two pages, that you think in this rhythm of two pages. Now, a typical comic is, you know, 22 pages, but you're usually writing longer form stuff, either, you know, four issue minis or something that can be turned into a graphic novel. do you find that that two-page thing is just kind of your own personal rhythm, or something that you've learned the hard way, or something that, you know, your Deadpool artist comes in and says, hey, George, this is how I like to work? What was that evolution? I've talked to a lot of people about these different ways in which they compartmentalize their stories and decide what the length of those arcs or beats are, and I personally find that very fascinating.
I like it. I feel like, you know, page one, you're kind of setting up, and then page two, there's a reveal. There's something to, and it just keeps the rhythm. Like, I don't know. I think my books are pretty snappy in their pacing, and it's because you don't sit on anything for too long. And yeah, so that's kind of just how I like to do it. I do like my dialogue, and I do like to kind of have fun and talking and stuff like that. And so sometimes there'll be just two pages of, you know, characters, you know, chatting and things like that. I try not to have too much talking heads. I always try and have them like be doing something, you know, not just going for a walk, but maybe they're axe throwing, or they're, you know, or maybe they're training and they're fighting with their swords and practicing, and just something visually interesting, because it is a visual medium. But yeah, for the most part, I do like those kind of two page scenes, just so that you can have that page turn reveal, you know, and the even numbers there just keeps it fun, I think.
You've done indie books, you know, you were working on Fire Engine Red, you did Cover of Darkness, which you kickstarted. I'd be remiss if I just glossed over this idea that somehow you ended up working with someone who had worked for one of the big two. How did Mr. Garza's relationship and yours and working on a book together, how did that come about?
Well, okay, so I looked into, when I decided I needed help making my book, I was like, well, who am I going to get? And I kind of looked around online, and different advice came through saying, try and work with someone locally. That way, you know, you can go and see them in person. A lot of times, like, I was just kind of getting warned even before I get started that, you know, you want to be able to have a face to that name, to that email.
Solid advice. And, yeah, really good advice, I think. Yeah.
So I reached out to John Delaney, who's an artist that worked on Adventures in the DC Universe and Simpsons and Futurama, and he lives in my town here. So I kind of like sneaked on him. He had a show at the art gallery in town here.
Are you creeping on John Delaney? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, because I didn't know him, right? And so I was like, well, how am I going to find this guy? And he didn't have like any social media or anything at the time. So I went down to the art gallery because he had a show going on there. And the curator at the art gallery actually just like gave me his email address. He's like, here. I'm like, oh.
No, it's funny. It's comics. You know, you said something earlier in the interview, which is that comics is not like a regular job where you can put in your interview, right? You can go to your interview rather, or put in your resume and then start on Monday. Like, you have to figure out a way in somehow. And while it is maybe a little bit strange, the front desk in this case of John Delaney's company was his art dealer, right? The art gallery that he had work at, you know, sized you up, I guess, and then said, yes, here is his personal contact information.
Well, I kind of lied. I was like, oh, I'm really interested in getting John to make something really special for me, private commission. And they're like, oh, okay. So it was, you know, a bit of a fib. But yeah, John actually read my script and was like, yeah, this is really solid, dude. And yeah, and then he set me up with Allie. Yeah, and actually got me a job working as an associate editor at his startup company, which was called ComicStream, which is like a digital comic books app that had like all original content. And we did that for a few years, and not sure what's happening with the app right now, but it got me a gig in comics before I even, you know, had my first pages done.
Right. And so, in the interest of full disclosure, that's how you and I met, and I did a project also with ComicStream. And so we've kept in touch ever since.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I've appreciated you right from the first time I met you, actually, and it comes across so effortlessly, even in our conversation here, is how you light up whenever you talk about the medium. Whenever you're talking about comics, there's this, like, you know, it's just an honest appreciation and love for it, which has caused you, you know, to stalk professional comic book makers to their home addresses, it sounds like. So I'm not sure now whether what side I stand on. But what I do find interesting is that when you showed up to say, hey, I've got a script, it wasn't dream smoke. It wasn't a promise. It wasn't this idea. So many people show up sometimes and they're like, I have a great idea for a book. You had done the work, you had written the script, you had, you know, put the time in. And so rather than pitch somebody's ear off, which is sometimes the bad side of this business, you just handed him the work and said, okay, right?
Yeah. I know sometimes as a writer, though, it is hard to get anyone to even just read a script. So that was nice that he actually did read it and checked it out. And yeah, and he's like, yeah, it's a solid. And we've been kind of good friends ever since. So we actually share a studio together now in town.
Amazing. So this, again, we glossed over it. So somehow you're working with a Marvel Daredevil or Marvel Deadpool artist just suddenly. And it was just on the recommendation. It's like being in the mafia, right? I've often joked that comics is like the mafia. It's, you know, you got to know somebody.
Kind of, yeah. Like, so John actually, his company bought my script for like real money, which like that doesn't ever happen as far as I know. So that was like kind of a home run for me. And then he hired Ali to work on it. And they were developing it for the Comic Stream app. And then from there, I started working on other projects because like basically the writing was done. And so I started working on my monster book. It's called Cover Darkness, and it's kind of like Game of Thrones meets Universal Monsters. And I teamed up with an artist named MJ Hiblin on that one. I have a co-writer too, my cousin Crystal, and I write it together. And MJ Hiblin has like 250,000 followers on Instagram, and his art is very greasy and dirty and not what you normally see in comics, and it's pretty fun. And and he's pretty fast too, so we got a few issues together and we collected into a graphic novel, and I hit the convention circuit with it. And yeah, it's been fun. It hasn't all been like super smooth though. Like in 2019 I did like 18 shows, and some of my shows on the West Coast were like really successful, but they were like huge shows. And then I like planned out like a road trip for myself, and not all conventions are created equal. I was going to like some small places like Columbus, Ohio and Madison, Wisconsin. And as an independent guy, it's like people aren't necessarily there to see me. So I really depend on having like some foot traffic in front of me. And if there's no one walking by, there's no one for me to sell to. And it was a grind. I actually felt really bad because I had left my wife and my daughter to go on this road trip. I had 4 cons in 4 weeks. And it was just really becoming very apparent to me that like I wasn't going to make any money on this thing. If I spent all my money on hotels and eating out, I'd come home after the 4 weeks, you know, with nothing to show for it. So in order to like actually come home with a few, you know, bucks in my pocket, I was like sleeping in truck stops and showering at the truck stop there and sleeping in my van. It was a rough go, dude. And it was like November, October. It was cold too.
George, you're telling the story of every band I've ever known, right? No matter how much of a rock star, no matter how big the crowd, wherever they arrived, if you're an indie band, at some point you are sleeping in the van, because that is the only way to make it economically viable for a day rate. It's just,
yeah, absolutely. I was sleeping in the van. It felt kind of rock and roll. It also kind of felt a little homeless.
It's hard on the ego, especially if you're bouncing between a big show and a small show, right? Where you realize that the only difference between you and a named person is that someone, you know, quote unquote named person, is that other people have heard of them, but their work may or may not be any better. And if people had just heard of your work, they'd line up for you too.
If we're going to impress a skeptical world, we'll have to make faster progress.
It's kind of hard going to like after parties at like, you know, fancy hotels where like, you know, big name creators are, you know, getting flown in and put up in the hotel. And I'm like trying to like, you know, clean up at the truck stop so I can like look presentable.
Oh my gosh. There is an adventure story, which is too long to retell now, but the really short version is that one night the building that I was staying in got completely locked down and evacuated in the middle of one of the shows. So at 5 a.m, I found myself in a restaurant bathroom, shaving and showering as best a person can shower in the sink of a restaurant bathroom, and trying to look presentable for this media interview that I was having like in an hour. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I haven't slept. I'm standing in this bathroom in my underwear, just hoping that this little rickety door lock will hold together. And this is what, you know, this is the proximity to fame, is like within an hour, I'm going to be on a national television spot, but they won't know that I spent the previous hour trying to pretend that I had a place to sleep. Yeah. So it's part of the gatekeeping process. It's just the way that humbleness is created, I think. And it's important.
It's so interesting at these conventions because like at some conventions, the comic book creators have the same access to the green room as, you know, the movie stars that are there. And so, you know, he'll be going to get a coffee in the back and, you know, and
there's Mark Hamill. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of crazy, right? And then you always try and like, I don't know, I try and play it cool, though. I never ask anyone for photos because I know they're there like selling photos.
Yeah,
so that doesn't seem nice.
Yeah, never. I never ask for a favor or an introduction or, you know, in the green room. No, because we're all just trying to get some food. It's been a 15-hour day, right?
Yeah,
for sure.
Always trying to be nice in there. But I do like it when they come to my table. If they come to my table, I'm pitching them hard. And I go right into, like, my salesman stuff. And I'm wheeling and dealing. And they're usually smiling pretty good. So,
well, you know, and that's it. That's the place for it. Right. There's nothing wrong with standing in front of a person trying to sell their books if they try to sell their books to you. I mean, I think that's totally fine. I can remember being super nervous. I was first starting out with my very first independent comic I had, and Steve Niles came up to check it out. And this was right around all the fame surrounding 30 Days of Night. And, you know, I had followed his indie career and he had such a do-it-yourself attitude. And I was just so I was like, oh, my goodness, this is Steve Niles. And I asked him, he bought one of the books. And so I was like, so pumped. And I know enough. It's kind of like your story with John. I knew so much about him that I was like, hey, you know, I'd like to draw something in the book for you. What'll it be? I know he's going to say Frankenstein. I know, because I was obsessed with him as a creative force. So I knew what his favorite was and I knew which one. And so it felt like such a strange situation to be like, what should I draw for you? And in my mind, I'm like, it'll be Frankenstein. Oh, I'd love it if you could draw Frankenstein. Which Frankenstein, I say? And he's like, oh, well, the one from the book. I don't, you know, the movie version is not the accurate one. I knew he would say that too, right? And I'm already drawing Frankenstein's long flowing hair from the book before he even finishes because I like nervous sketched. You know, like some people start when they're nervous. I started drawing immediately, like in advance of what I knew his answer would be. And, you know, that's way back in my early days of comics, but it's normal. I think that's the thing that people forget is that everybody is just starting. It doesn't matter what they're doing. And if they're on a new project, no matter how famous they were, they're still just starting. Right? Because no one's heard of, no one knows what's
going on. One of the, like, funnest interactions I've had with it's just terrible actually but years ago, before I was actually making comics, I was at LA Comic Con, and like my day job is I work with adults with developmental disabilities, and I had taken this woman that I was supporting. We went to Disneyland and we did the LA Comic Con, and we're hanging out on the show floor there, and Gene Simmons and his son are just kind of walking through the crowd looking at books. And the lady that is there supporting, like, really loudly, like, pointed at him and said, "Hey, everybody, look, it's Richard Simmons."
Oops.
And Gene Simmons turned around and gave her just the nastiest glare I've ever seen.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Oh. You remember Richard Simmons, right? Like sweating to the oldies.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know. And if you're Gene Simmons, that hurts. That probably cuts deep. But about as innocent as it could possibly be, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man. So amazing. So you're making comics. You're on the, you're putting the miles in. And this is what I appreciate about anyone that's willing to do it. You know, we create ourselves through what we do. And you said, I'm going to make comics. So you made a comic. You said you wanted to, for people to read the comics. So you get on the road and you show it to people. And even though it's hard, you're not giving up. And this has led you to a couple of really great projects. And you have a new one coming up called Resilient, which I think you're putting on Kickstarter. And then it's also going to be in previews, so available wherever comics are sold. Do you want to give our dear listener the soundbite, the pitch, the boil down of what Resilient is all about?
Yeah. So Resilient is my first series released by a publisher. So I'm really excited about that. And I've been working at this for three, 4 years now, trying to get in. And so it's from Absolute Comics Group. It's about a woman. She's a judo teacher. And she, in a tragic accident, she loses her arms. And so she has to go through a recovery and kind of adapt to her new situation of not having any arms. And she's having, at the same time, a really difficult time with her husband. They're trying to conceive and have a baby, and things aren't going very well that way too. And then she gets these robotic kind of pink mecha arms, and kind of the sins of her husband's past kind of catch up with him, and she needs to go rescue him. So it's a pretty fun book where there's a lot of action and car chases and, you know, sword fights and robot arms and blood and guts and gore and fun. As our lead character has to go and get her man, but at the same time, it also talks about kind of some deeper things that I wanted to talk about. I haven't lost my arms, but I broke my back. I had heart surgery when I was 15, so I've gone through some pretty major injuries and had to recover from them. And then my wife and I had a hard time trying to conceive our daughter. And so these are topics that I wanted to talk about. And I think it really gives the story some heart, you know, where you're connected with the characters so that when the craziness happens and the blood starts flying, you're kind of dialed in.
Yeah. What a great, anytime that we come to the other side of a tragedy or a hardship, that we can find a way to transmute it into something of use. I find that to be such a great tool for storytelling. You know, like I would never wish a tragedy on anybody, but I would wish introspection on everybody. And if you've had something bad happen to you and you can figure out a way to talk about it, even if it means writing a story about a girl with robot arms, you know, fighting the mob or fighting, you know, any way that you can express that, I think it leads to good places, right? How hard was it though for you to put that stuff, that real stuff, into the story?
Well, it kind of poured out of me, actually. Like, you know, there's, well, I know you've read it, and you've read the second issue too, where she's going through a difficult time, you know, after having lost her arms and things like that. And, you know, some of those things were, you know, really tied to reality in a sense, you know, so just kind of losing your mind a little bit when you're not able to do the things you normally can do. It felt easy for me to write. But at the same time though, like, I don't really like those kind of stories of, you know, people, of slow dramas of people like being, you know, kind of finding themselves and being true to themselves. It's just not my favorite kind of genre to consume. I like action movies. I like fighting and kung fu and car chases. I'm a simple man. I like these sort of things. And so I wanted to intertwine these. Give me an uppercut
with a cybernetic limb any day is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's a way to kind of have a fun kind of, you know, commando-esque story, but, you know, with a little bit more heart and, you know, connection. Not that Commando's not great. That's Jeff Lowe wrote that too.
Wait, is that true?
Yeah.
Original Commando.
Wrote Commando.
What? That is a deep cut of nerd knowledge that I did not know.
He was nearly 7 foot tall.
No, he was shorter, but built solid. Broad shoulders, heavy arms.
His face, what there was of it, 'twas terrible, terrible.
You have a story. You have an idea. You've got some personal issues that you roll up into it, but you don't want to waste too much time on a type of story you yourself don't like reading or spending a lot of time reading too much of. So you layer it in this action and these action beats, and you have something that you like. At what point did you take it to a publisher? At what point were you showing it to people and saying, okay, I think it's ready. I think it can be shared. I think it's good enough for people that I don't know, for strangers to spend their money on. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, it was a little tough because I didn't have the fortune of like having the comic stream pay for Ali Garza to work on my book. That I was self-funding this book. I was already self-funding other projects. And so while I was confident in it, I just didn't have the finances to like, you know, get this thing to completion, you know. So 5 issue is the first story arc. So I self-funded the first issue, and then I just started shopping that. And luckily with the strength of the first issue, I did find a publisher. And I took it around. Anyone who's thinking about breaking into comics, I would sure recommend going to New York Comic Con. That's a great place to actually meet decision makers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you go to the other shows and it's like sometimes it's event staff, or, you know, it's not necessarily someone who's actually going to give you like a yes or no on your book.
Totally.
Whereas, yeah, at New York I was able to meet like quite a few, and I found a home with Absolute Comics. I had a bit of an in with them too. I had tabled through my road trips next to Jamie Tindall, who's a Canadian artist, and he's the artist on White Widow, which is one of the biggest selling independent books right now. And so I tabled next to him quite a few times. And so when I went to New York Comic Con and I talked to Benny Powell, the editor in chief there, he had already heard my name. He's like, oh yeah, Jamie knows you, right? You're Jamie's guy. I'm like, well, yeah, I know Jamie. So
that's... Hey, we already know someone who knows you. You come on in here. Come on in here, George. Yeah, I get it. I get what's happening. I will speak for the dear listener's sake about the culture of, say, San Diego Comic-Con versus the culture around a show like New York. New York City, because it's the home of so many publishers and because so many book-related events and publishing events happen in New York, there's a much higher percentage of people, as George said, who make decisions on the publishing level, who attend that show looking for talent and want to find some people to work with, as opposed to San Diego, which is, you know, it's media heavy. If you've got a video game to sell, that's a good place to go. If you've got some media rights you're trying to get hooked up, that's a great show to, even if you're not exhibiting at the show, to just be at and moving around with the people there. And so you got to, you have to know what to expect from the places you're in. So I've myself had a lot of luck at New York Comic Con for the same reasons. There's just people who are looking for people to help on their projects. Now, yeah, not everyone knows my name like they seem to know yours whenever I walk into a room, but you know, we take the opportunities that we can find. So tell me about Absolute Comics. What's the scoop with that company?
They've only been around for a few years now. They have White Widow, I Make Boys Cry. They're doing fantastic business on there. They have a kind of neat marketing system where they launch a Kickstarter at the same time as the book goes into previews. And so in previews, which is like the order form for order magazine for comic book stores, they'll offer like 2 or 3 covers available, like one main cover and then a variant or two. And then on the Kickstarter, they'll have like things like exclusive covers, metal covers, lenticular covers, things like this. So, and if everything goes smoothly, you actually, if you back the Kickstarter, you get the books just before the stores get them. So it allows them to kind of, market their, put all their marketing and promotion at one time, right when it's in Previews magazine. They're talking to stores, telling people to bring them in, and they're promoting their Kickstarter and trying to get the word out on that.
I find that so clever. I find that so clever because there's so many Kickstarters where I've missed it, or I've just heard about it, or I hear it's being fulfilled and I'm like, ugh. And I go to the comic store, right? If they were also on the shelf that month, all that goodwill would be resting and leaning against my buying habits for sure. That's a very clever strategy. A hard one, I think, to get right though, like to line up all those ducks in a row, because Previews requires a lot of advanced planning and scheduling and getting stuff shipped way ahead.
Yeah, I think the editor-in-chief there, Benny Powell, he's been in the industry for over 25 years and worked as an editor at Marvel and started his own company there. And he has a pretty good handle on how all those things work. They did have some hiccups in the past. They were printing out of China, and then things would take kind of too long to come in. And so they've actually started doing all of their printing like locally. Like they're based out of Orlando, and so they have a printer there, and they actually their printer does printing for Scout Comics as well, and then they have a truck that ships to right to Diamond. Sorry about that. I kind of got a little distracted.
No, it's all good. It's all good. So Absolute Comics, then it goes Kickstarter, Previews, and for the dear listener who's not sure, Previews, up until really last week, was the main way that comic stores got their comics delivered. Since COVID and since Diamond has halted distribution during COVID, it allowed both DC and Marvel to slide out of their contracts with Diamond. And so they've gone exclusive into other distributors. So it'll be interesting to see how that whole landscape shakes out as the world starts up again. But I think a combination of Kickstarter plus comic stores is a really smart thing.
Yeah. And we have some exclusive covers for Resilient that I'm like super excited about. I've actually just brought on Ed Bennis from like Justice League and Birds of Prey. He's doing a cover for us that's exclusive on the Kickstarter. We also have Jeffrey the Chamba Cruz. I just like saying the Chamba, but he's an artist that's worked for like Udon and Street Fighter, and he.
That's where I know that name. Udon stuff. Yeah, for sure.
So we have some really cool exclusive ones, and then retail. I've got one from our series artist Vin Zaltabanis. Then we have Ali Garza doing a cover, and Andy Bellinger of Kill Shakespeare. Mother Trucker, Swamp Thing, Southern Cross. He's done such a sick cover for us. It's actually lenticular. Like we're going back to the 90s, and you turn it and like her arms are gone, and then you turn it and then she's got her robot arms and her katana.
Okay, yeah. I'll admit the 80s action hero, like violence exploitation style of storytelling that you're describing there. I'm there for it. And I've read your script, so I know where it's going. And, you know, I was leading some of those questions about like you putting a little of yourself into those stories, because you and I've had those conversations about how to turn that knob and get like the right amount of action and not too much drama, or just the right amount of drama, you know. But if John Wick can spend three movies killing, I don't know, 900 to 1,000 people just because his dog got killed, you don't need too much motivation if people are showing up and they know what kind of story to expect, right?
Yeah, but you take that dog out of John Wick.
No, and it's awful. And you, yeah, I know.
Yeah, you don't have the same story, you know?
Yeah. Why, when the stitches are out, he'll pass for a normal, quite attractive teenager.
Did you see Kong versus Godzilla recently?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah, it needed a dog or something at the beginning.
It did need a dog,
right? It needed something. I was there to see, like, I have no criticisms for a movie that promised me a giant lizard would fight a giant monster. Like, it delivered. right? Big lizard, big monkey, punching each other. It totally.
I like the aircraft carrier fight. That was
that was
pretty solid.
It does fall apart a little bit on the scaling. Like the aircraft carrier is therefore bigger than some of the biggest skyscrapers that they show in the film that he kicks over. Like there's someone was not doing their scale modeling and figuring that out. And then eventually Godzilla's like, oh, I want to fight a monkey. I can sense him at the center of the earth. I'll just blast a hole into the center of the earth. So there was a few like moments where I feel like any flimsy elements to my own plots can be forgiven because, you know, that movie exists. So it will help make way for any mistakes in my own stories. How do you deal with criticism of your work? Have you ever faced someone who's read some of your stuff or they're looking at it at a show and they just, it's just not for them? How do you deal with that?
Truthfully, I haven't had a ton of like negative criticism. Like on the show floor, sure, I've had lots of people not buy my book, you know, but they haven't read it. So I let that go pretty easily. I think, you know, the only book I've really been out there selling is my monster book, Cover of Darkness, which, as I said earlier, like the art style is a little bit different than most comics. It's a little grittier and it's not for everyone. Like I think it's fantastic and I love it, but I understand it's not for everyone. So I think the biggest compliment that I ever get is, to go in the total opposite direction of your question, is
people don't when someone like me, they love me and they know my name, David.
No, is when they come back and they want to buy the second issue. That is like the best feeling in the world.
Best feeling ever. Yeah.
When people buy the first issue, it's like, okay, well, maybe they liked me, you know, maybe I was charming, or maybe they liked the art. Probably more likely they like the art, so they're going to get it. But when they come back for the second issue, it's the biggest compliment that you can ever get. So far with like negative reviews online, there hasn't been a lot, but the one or two that there have been like, well, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. So denial is how I've been handling it.
Is the shield. Yeah. I mean, I wish I had some sage advice. I've been on the receiving end of some pretty harsh criticism over the course of my creative career. And you realize that it doesn't matter if they're not making, I'll tell you this. The one that when it hurts is if it's from another person who also creates things. That's when it'll slip under the armor. It gets past all my mental defenses, all of my practiced ability to say like, oh, they're not in the arena, so it doesn't matter. They're shouting from the stands, but I'm standing in the sand right now, right? But if it's somebody who is there, who has like been making a living, making books or been changing people's lives, making stuff, and they're like, oh yeah, it's not very good. Or, you know, oh, I didn't like it or whatever. That's when it just, oh, cuts. It hits so deep. It's so deep, hurts so much.
I keep on talking about like good things instead of talking about bad things. But when Fire Engine Red was at Comic Stream, they actually had Jim Kruger as part of the team there, you know, like Eisner Award winning, you know, writer of Justice and all sorts of great things. And he did a pass on my book and he really didn't change like hardly anything at all. He added like one or two like really funny jokes and I was like, okay, that's sweet. I'll take those. But yeah, he said it was a good story. So I was like, I was kind of flying on top of the world on that.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. Especially, and that's the reverse, right? Is when somebody who does like it, and I've been in that position too, where someone who has maybe forgotten more about writing than you've even learned gives it a thumbs up, right? Those are the moments that really fire you up. And those things, you know, the best part about that is it has nothing to do with fame and nothing to do with money and everything to do with craft, right? Like if you respect the work that they've done because it's made you feel something and you were able to make them feel something, that's to me the real reward. That's my overly sentimental answer there. Said it's its own reward. The work is its own reward.
You know what? Actually, I had a guy come back. I had met him because I've done quite a few shows on the West Coast, and he came back for like he had a booth of his own. He was selling like leather cosplay stuff or something like that. And every time I'd see him, he'd like pick up like the new book. And I had seen him on the floor, and he hadn't come by. And I was like, oh no, maybe he didn't like the last issue. And then he came by on like the last day, and he's like, oh man, I was trying to get over here and I've been so busy. He's like, oh, I gotta take it. He's like, what do you got for me? And I was like, I was just like overwhelmed with just like, you know, just emotion of like this guy, like, you know, picking up issue after issue after issue. It was like, oh man, dude, I just wanted to give it to him. I didn't. I sold it, but I did. I felt like I got to pay for my gas to these shows, man. But I felt so happy that he's just like seeking me out every time. It's a great feeling.
One of the things that I do sometimes at shows, if I have, particularly if I have books for young people, because I write stuff that's like scary and for adults, and we also do stuff for young people, I sometimes will have an age limit or height limit, you know, like I just make a joke about it. And I just, when a kid goes by and they seem interested in what we're doing, but it's clear, like, you know, parents are on budgets or people have, you know, they have their own interests or whatever, I'll have stuff that's like genuinely free, but only if you're a kid. Right. Mm. And so the flip of this is one time there was a family that I had seen before and I saw them talking. They'd already had got some free stuff from me. And they sent their kid again, hoping that I wouldn't remember that I'd already given them some free stuff so that they could get some more free stuff. I gave it to them anyway, because, you know, I didn't want to put that kid in the middle of the transaction. But part of it was this idea that, you know, if you like it enough to try and convince your child to be like the comics mule here, I'm just going to let you have it. And at first it bugged me, but by the end of the show, it actually felt like the biggest compliment, you know, like I'm going to put my child at risk to get another copy of that comic.
But you do a lot of little doodles and sketches in your books too, right? Like
you're... Yeah, all the time. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I was selling my monster book, I'd already sold the copy, right? It was a done deal. And the guy left and then he came back and he's like, oh man, I'm really digging this art in here. It's so good. Would you mind doing a little sketch for me? And oh. I didn't have the heart to say, I'm not the artist. I was like, all right, so I'll, yeah, sure, I can do. And so I drew like a little vampire and he looked at it and he looked at me and then he's like, so it takes you a while to make the book, eh?
Oh. Oh, that cuts deep. Oh my goodness. Well, I work with you know, anyone listening to podcasts, of course, knows Justin Courage, Chasing Artwork. I've had similar things like that where I'll go to a school visit and they've heard that I'm coming, and like people have, you know, the worst is if Justin's visited the school before, and so they've heard like, oh, the guy who did Cassie and Tonk or the guy who did Rust and Water is coming to the school, and then I'm there and I'm just the guy who wrote it, right? And then I find myself being like, well, I can draw too, you know, give me that book, I'll draw something in it for you. Never the same. It always just feels like the kid is like, get out of here, man. It's these shattered robots. I like, get out of here. All these dumb words in the way. So yeah, there is a, not everyone who consumes the medium understands what a collective effort goes into making those books. And it's part of that, right? You just have to accept those little pieces.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of people don't appreciate writers enough because you get a lot of that. Oh, you're just the writer. And it's like, yeah, I'm just the guy who like paid to make this thing happen.
You cling to your skepticism. I'll hold to my beliefs. And someday, very soon possibly, I'll prove them so conclusively that even cynics like you all over the world will be convinced.
Let's get into the nuts and bolts. So this can be our moment to talk about that. In so many comic book relationships, you know, the person putting the deal together and putting the money on the table is often the writer.
Yeah, I think the writer risks more, you know, like the artists that generally they're getting paid for their time, right? And you know, and rightfully so, like their work is very time consuming, and it's a skill that takes years and years and years to develop, and I'm not putting that down at all. Obviously I value it, I pay for it. I knew I couldn't do it myself. I knew I didn't want to spend the time to learn how to become a, you know, great artist. So I do value it immensely, but I do think it is kind of the writer that's kind of putting the gamble in there more, you know, they're risking their money to try and create something. And then on the flip side, they're kind of hustling to kind of regain or recoup that investment.
Yeah. And so for the dear listener that's wondering how that usually works, often in an independent comic, the writer who is approaching an artist pays the page rate or the day rate of that artist out of their own pocket up front, pays the printing cost of the book often out of their own pocket up front, then pays for booths at shows and promotes that book out of their own pocket up front, and is trying to recoup now all of that outlay of money. The artist is often doing another book somewhere with somebody else, right? And one of the criticisms within the industry is that sometimes, and it'd be good, I'm going to put you on the spot here, George, sometimes the writer then, because they've put that financial risk up front, takes the position that any reward that comes from a book now is theirs alone, that they have the copyright, that they are the intellectual property right holder. And as time has gone on in the comic book landscape, many artists have taken issue with this as an idea. Where do you stand on that? What do you do with your artists? Do you share this with them? Have I opened up a hornet's nest here? Are you in trouble?
No. Yeah, just being real, I do sign contracts with my artists that give me the copyright and ownership of the property, and they're kind of a work for hire type situation. I understand they're not giving me like a discounted rate. I'm paying like their full page rate, and I wouldn't expect them to want to do. It's a different thing if you're like a Zack Snyder, or, you know, or somebody who's going to go out and launch a book, and the artist can be like, yeah, I'm going to put this time in and I'm going to draw this, and because I know it's going to sell. And so I will put my time and effort into it for a portion of the ownership of it. But because I'm, you know, somewhat unproven, you know, pretty mostly unproven, I understand why the artist wouldn't want to work at a discounted rate, or work, you know, as a 50-50 partner with, you know, just with no page rate, things like that. I understand why they wouldn't want to take that risk, right? Because it's an immense amount of time to put into something to do it. But if they're not going to take the risk with me, if they're going to get paid up front, then I think I should own the property.
And I think that's a reasonable position to take. And the people who are listening who've heard me take the other position many times in my own is because you're supposed to advocate for yourself. So George is advocating for his hard work, and it's my job to advocate for my hard work. And if he says to me, hey, come in and do this book for me, I'm going to own everything at the end. Those are the deals that I personally pass on, because there are too many stories of, you know, your Jack Kirby's are the most famous, but even most recently, your Ed Brubaker's. He creates the Winter Soldier, right? Gets nothing for a $6 billion character.
I don't think that's true, though. I'm not, you know what? I'm just going to say it. I'm not on Ed Brubaker's side here.
Well, he's not on his own side. I'll say also that this isn't something that he's complained about. He said that he got famous enough to sell his indie books at a great
rate. Exactly.
Yeah, but
right, yeah, like he wouldn't have the audience if he hadn't worked on the Marvel books. So he's, you know, by working on those books and, you know, X-Men and Captain America and having generated like a huge fan base, now he can go out and sell his indie books, and, you know, and people line up for it, and he's gonna get his Netflix or Amazon Prime deal because his work is really great. and he's gonna, you know, do really well financially on one of his original properties. But
now,
Bucky Barnes wasn't an original property.
Comics, he didn't create that. And that comes back down to Jack Kirby, who did create Bucky Barnes and didn't get paid for it either.
Yeah, that's rough. That's rough. But those are, I'm sure I've done a little bit of work for other people creating characters for them. And if somehow those things take off, if those things take off phenomenally, then, you know, that's their property. I got paid up front for it. Right.
Yeah. You know, I've worked on projects where where I wasn't sure how well they would sell. And I was in a position where it would be fun to work on it and how great it would be to be a part of that book or project. And then they sold phenomenally well. And I was like, ooh, should have taken a percentage. Right.
That is getting back to the artist writer relationship, though. Like, there are different kinds of splits. It's not just all or nothing, totally. Right? Like,
yeah.
You can do like, okay, maybe the page rate is normally, you know, $200 a page. And instead we do $100 a page and 25% ownership or something, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah. And I've done deals like that too, where I'll take a less of a cut on a book that I really feel like I'll be able to push and they're going to push and maybe, or a book I really believe in, or maybe it has a social element, like an ability to make some change in the right places. I'll take less of a page rate and more of a back end in the hopes that it does well.
What is impossible for others becomes a daily event for you.
I'm delighted to impress you.
I am a little nervous about these conversations though, because it's like, I don't want to like have artists hate me. I love artists.
You said something really, I think, in your own defense, really quite clear. You paid their asking rate and you didn't ask for a discount because you were accepting the risk and you're not a known entity. These are all reasons for an artist to take the money and not in exchange, because often in indie comics, people will promise how big a book will be instead of money. Right. And that's awful. Oh, it's going to be the next huge thing. And if you have 10% of this or 5% or 25% or 50%, oh, you're going to get so rich. Just please give me 500 hours of work.
That's crazy.
Right? It's crazy. And it happens too often. And so you're doing the reverse. You're saying every hour you put in, I'll pay for what you asked me to pay for. But if I'm going to pay that full rate, then I'm accepting that risk and it's debt I have to carry. And for people who aren't, you know, sure about what these numbers are, you know, an average indie book can easily, indie graphic novel, be $25,000 to $50,000 to illustrate it, to pay someone their rate to work on it for a full year, and then another $25,000 to print the thing. So if you're carrying $75,000 of debt and risk forward into the next few years, well, shouldn't you be the one that then gets the reward? Right? It is a big gamble. Well, I've been on that side.
Yeah. I do my, accounting every year, and comics is not, I haven't been in the black yet. I've been getting close, but yeah, it's, I've lost every month, every year. But the margins are getting closer. So,
right. And if you're looking just yearly, then of course it will seem negative, but if you are in your position, holder of the copyright in perpetuity, then if you got close in the first couple of years, well, it is going to make money over its lifetime.
That's true. But that's one thing that's kind of interesting though, is because like, as a creative person, I want to keep on creating things.
Oh, I know.
But then you kind of have to like wonder, like, well, if I have four books on the table, isn't that enough? Like, if I'm selling four books, why do I need to make five and six and seven? I'm still going to probably sell the same amount of stuff. So it's kind of hard to keep justifying your like addiction of like creating things.
It's true. It is true. And that's why, you know, honestly, on my own side, developing a hybrid model where I produce and print books that I completely control, own, and I'm taking all that risk myself. And so those books on the table are all my risk. And other books are ones that I've done through a publisher where they've assumed that risk. And that's the way that I can keep what I think is a good output of a couple of books a year and sometimes more, because I'm not taking on all that risk and debt myself. That would just be, you know, you'd be hanging yourself. And you never know which one is the one that's gonna hit, right?
Yeah.
So
absolutely. It's crazy. Like, so I've got four books that are really pretty far into development, and Resilient was the one that was kind of the least evolved as far as like actually having things made. I only had the one issue done, and it's the first one to go to print, to find a home. You know, it was also the one that was the most personal and maybe the least commercial, I felt. You know, like the other ones are kind of like designed to make toys, or they have monsters in them, or, you know, things like this that I thought would be like really easy sells. And this one is different than those ones. I don't have my pitch down perfect yet, you know, and because it's not as easy for me to pitch that one.
You know what though? It's the kind of project when you talk about the medium, comics medium, comics are sold on the strength of their covers to a person who's not heard of it. And if you're into comics, you're into genre stuff. So there's this great Venn diagram of people who are into genre, into comics. And if you have a character with badass pink robot arms, they're going to look inside. Like, they're going to, right? So if you're a publisher of comics and you hear this description of the character, you can't help but realize that that's going to be a character that on the cover is going to sell the concept. Right? The aspirational nature of like, oh man, having your arms gone would be terrible, but having super arms would be great. Right? These things, it sounds silly, but these are the small constituent parts that build up to why a person takes a book off the cover, or off the counter, I should say. Right?
Yeah, no, that makes sense too. I've been really lucky with the variant covers too that we've got, and Vince Altabanis is great. I should talk about him for a minute. He's from Paris, France. He's an artist that mostly works in video games. He's done some work for like board games, like an alien board game, like Aliens, the thing, with Sigourney Weaver. And he hasn't really done a ton in comics. He's done like some Zenoscope covers, like really cheesecakey kind of things. And he seems like he has a different variant cover on a Kickstarter every month, but that's, you know, he mostly works in video games, and he's just an incredible talent. He really puts a lot of effort into every single panel, and it's been great working with him. English is his second language, so there is a little bit of back and forth on like panel descriptions sometimes. It's like, what do you mean here? And it's like, so sometimes I send him a picture of like, kind of like, this is kind of what I was thinking, but we're getting through, we're almost done issue four now, and so it's a 5-issue story arc on that one.
Do you speak any French?
None, no, zip.
So really what you're saying is that French is his first language, and French is your like no language. So really the problem is not him, I'm seeing here.
Oh yes, I guess so.
Right. If you would keep that perspective, he already speaks 1.5 languages. So I think he's got a leg up on us both.
He's a good dude, man. I met him actually just for the first time on my, like on, I have a YouTube channel called Inside Comics, and I interviewed him, and we met for the first time on the show there. And
wow. How was that to meet face to face for the first time with someone you normally correspond with?
Yeah, because it's been like 2 years just back and forth with emails, and it's good. He's drinking his beer, smoking his cigarette, and like just he's like just chatting with me, and he seems really passionate. He said that all he does is, you know, his two passions in life, no sports, no nothing like that, not music, drawing and beer.
Well, eventually I think he might have to give up one of those. I hope he picks the one we both want him to keep going with. What is next for you and for Resilient? And the drop some dates that people can put in their heads, drop some time, some places to find the book. This is your moment. For the dear listener, George doesn't like coming across like a salesman, because in his heart he is a creative person. So I'm absolving him of that. I'm just giving him an open window to give you all, the dear listeners, the information they need to get what is ultimately going to be a cool book.
Okay, so April 28th, Resilience is in Previews magazine. So go down to your local comic book store, tell them to bring in a copy of that from Absolute Comics Group. May 1st to 10th, it's on Kickstarter. It's partnered with another book called I Make Boys Cry, issue 2, and Resilient number 1. And we have exclusive covers on there. I'm really excited about Ed Benes's cover. I haven't seen it yet. He's working on it right now. That guy's a legend. So,
yeah, when will you see that? When
I just got an email as we're talking. I'm like, oh, I want to click on that and see.
I wonder where that enormous smile, dear listener, we're a podcast so you can't see him, but like he went Cheshire Cat just for a minute. And I couldn't figure out if it was just his like glow over talking about his own book, which is not really in his character. So that's good. That's awesome. You can click it.
And then the book will be in stores on June 30th. So if you order it through Previews, tell them to bring it in and then it'll be in stores June 30th. And then you guys can come find me hopefully in the fall. I'll be on the convention circuit. I got like a dozen cons booked all across North America. So hopefully they happen and then I'll get to meet you guys.
It's been wonderful talking with you, George. I appreciate all of your insight and your honesty about making comics and how you didn't resist the hot seat I put you on those contract questions. So we'll catch up with you again, I think, once Resilient is out in the world. I'd love to talk to you about, you know, the reaction, fan reaction. Maybe we'll find some good reviews and some bad reviews of it, and then we can talk about that. How's that sound?
You can just read me bad reviews and just watch my heart break in front of you.
Oh, it's just part of the process, right? Dr. Jonathan Ball has his own podcast called Writing the Wrong Way, and he is a friend of mine. And he often says that you can't be somebody's favorite band unless you're somebody else's least favorite band. So that just comes with the territory. This has been Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. This is Gregory Kamichuk encouraging you all to join the fight and make comics.